This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is presented in cooperation with the North Carolina Institute on Blindness. We are continuing with the reading of the book by Judge Craig Brown entitled, A Fork in the Road. Last week we left off in Chapter 9 with Craig Brown having been transferred from the care of the Student Health Services to the North Carolina Memorial Hospital. But there had been a doctor from the Student Health Services who had been deeply interested in the case and the causes of the problems being experienced, and he had made a good guess that it was Behçet's, and this a couple of years before the diagnosis was confirmed. The doctor had said, quote, "He hoped I did not have Behçet's syndrome." When my eye symptoms began in 1979, I saw my first ophthalmologist. I had never had eye problems, and my vision had always been 20/20. But that was about to change for the worse, and it was now time to call in a big gun. Dr. John Merritt was his name, and he was chairman of the Department of Ophthalmology at North Carolina Memorial Hospital. A Harvard-trained physician, he had absolutely no lack of intelligence, curiosity, or caring about the patients that he served. From the very beginning, he took an intense interest in my case, since it was so weird. He put the various pieces of the symptoms together and formed the first formal diagnosis of Behçet's syndrome in mid-September of 1979. His genius in identifying my healthcare problems was not good news for me. However, even the diagnosis did not help very much when there was no known cause, no known cure, and the doctors could only treat the symptoms, not the disease itself. I saw Dr. Merritt regularly for the next 4 years. I had never done that with any doctor, and I found it difficult getting used to some of it. I had never before had a serious healthcare problem of any kind, and Behçet's syndrome, in the early years, was an untamed monster as it raged through my body. Blindness became a medical certainty. It was only a question of how long I would have my eyesight and whether the treatments that existed for Behçet's would damage my overall health. I had to learn how to become an odds man on my life as well as on my eyesight. This was a hard thing to deal with in my 20s. Dr. Merritt was a taskmaster. I did not much care for it. Sometimes I did not like it at all. I did not much care about what I had to do. But I had no choice, and I learned to follow the rules. That is probably another reason I am still alive. At about the same time, I met my first rheumatologist, Dr. Norton Hadler. As an undergraduate and a medical student, Hadler had the best of two worlds, a Yale undergraduate degree and a Harvard Medical School degree. Hadler was also a taskmaster. Like Merritt, Dr. Hadler was a powerful man with powerful training, a mind that purred, curiosity that had no borders, and the heart that most doctors have for their calling. Most doctors would not be doctors unless they cared a whole lot. Since Behçet's syndrome had no known cause and no known cure in 1979, there were few medical treatments available. My treatment began with prednisone. Over the next 15 years, I ingested more than 100,000 milligrams of it. That enormous quantity in my 20s and 30s led to other medical complications. It was time to play the odds, and they favored prednisone to slow the progression of Behçet's syndrome. It did help for a good while. Instead of going blind in 2 to 4 years, it took 13. Those were not easy years. But I finished my education, crossed the curve of practical legal training, and most of all, I was honored with two wonderful children. As Dr. Merritt said, prednisone has no side effects, only known effects. The long-term effects are being realized now, some 20 years later. I did not begin chemotherapy until after the birth of my second child in 1992. For that, I am grateful because the side effects of chemotherapy are worse than those of the prednisone. The first gamble was on the prednisone. The odds favored the choice, and I learned Merritt had made a good call. When I graduated from the North Carolina School of Law with a J.D. degree and a master's degree of public policy from Duke in 1983, My dad, Fred Brown, told me I had no choice in where to go. I listened to Dad a lot, and I paid attention always to what he had to say because sometimes he did not say very much. No child of his with a chronic, rare medical condition was going to live in a small town with limited medical resources. Dad made the right call, too. I have lived ever since within easy distance of the Duke University Medical Center. That is another reason I am still alive today. I know that my health care is the combined effort of North Carolina Memorial Hospital and the Duke University Medical Center. That may seem like an odd combination, especially during basketball season. I will declare my allegiance now. I went to Duke University for a year, and I liked it. But I received my education at UNC Chapel Hill. So I cheer for North Carolina, especially and always against Duke. But I do respect Duke University and the Duke University Medical Center. My first doctor at Duke University Medical Center was Dr. Ralph Snyderman, a rheumatologist, who was an excellent doctor, but we did not stay together long. He ultimately became the chief executive officer of Duke University Medical Center. While we were not together long as doctor and patient, I was still getting the big guns. My dad would see to it always, and for as long as he lived. My next rheumatologist at Duke was my dad's doctor, too. Dr. David Caldwell was a Wake Forest man through and through, both undergraduate and medical school. Dr. Caldwell had been managing the Bichette side of my health care for more than 20 years. That is a long time to have any doctor, and he knows my case and me very well, inside and out. He has seen me up, and he has seen me down, and everywhere in between. He is a kind, deeply caring, and deeply thoughtful doctor who cares about his patients. There is a David Caldwell Foundation at Duke University Medical Center. You should give to it. I certainly will. My ophthalmologist at the Duke Eye Center was Dr. Robert Matchemer, who was a chairman of the Eye Center, too. Unlike my other doctors, Dr. Matchemer received his education at both the undergraduate and medical school levels in Germany. Like the rest of my doctors, he was brilliant. He helped to manage my decreasing eyesight and blindness over the years. With me as the patient, that was not necessarily an easy task. Dr. Matchemer was optimistic and realistic at the same time. I was never sure how those two goals would work together, but ultimately they did. He even got me on the Duke Eye Center board before I became a judge. It is about 20 years later now, and I am still on the board. I hope I will always be. Eyesight is a very important thing, and I do not want more people to lose theirs than we can help. However, vision does not have much to do with eyesight. Vision has more to do with the mind, the thought processes, and the imagination. Unlike everybody else, Dr. David Epstein was never my doctor. He became chairman of the Duke Eye Center in 1992. With the considerable help of a strong and talented faculty in ophthalmology, he built the Duke Eye Center into one of the best in the United States. He was a Johns Hopkins man for both undergraduate and medical school training. Let me give you some idea of Dr. Epstein's efforts. In 1992, there were 15 clinical faculty and 5 research faculty at the Duke Eye Center. Today, there are 46 and 13, respectively. Over 20 years, that is roughly a 300% growth in faculty staff. In addition, the Ruth and Herman Alpert Eye Research Institute opened in 2004 with 5 floors and 72,000 square feet of space. I am not a stockbroker, but I would buy any stock with that rate of return. You might want to give it to the Duke Eye Center, too. They are planning a new 5-story, 110,000-square-foot clinical building. While I have adjusted to the reality of my blindness, I will always hate it. And we need to do whatever we can to prevent blindness in the future. The proposed new clinical building at the Duke Eye Center will help greatly. From June 2006, I have to mention one last doctor. I know I will have more now and hereafter, because one of my goals is to see every department at the Duke University Medical Center, short of OBGYN. Dr. Barry Hurwitz had a good deal to do with saving my life and limiting the damage from the 2006 Bichette attack. I had never had a neurologist before, and I should have had one. But I was always afraid that Bichette's would someday lead to an attack on my brain. That scared me, so I never went to a neurologist until 2006. If I had, I would have recognized the onset of neurological symptoms days before my severe Bichette's attack on June 6th of that year. Neurological intervention might have helped a lot. And good Lord, what a bright mind Dr. Hurwitz was, so intelligent, and beyond me sometimes, it was a little bit scary. He received his undergraduate and medical school education in South Africa. Since I have been under a doctor's care since 1976, I have no way of remembering the name of every healthcare professional. There have been hundreds of healthcare professionals that have worked on my case over the years. I thank each and every one of them, and every doctor, nurse, physician's assistant, medical technician, and staff member at both hospitals. In case you did not know, you were there to make a difference. My life path should tell you that you made that difference. Thank you. Chapter 10, The Man of Steel. From the mouth of infants and nursing babes thou hast established strength because of thine adversaries, to make the enemy and the revengeful cease. Psalm 8:2. In a span of 2.5 years, my dad died. I lost the remainder of my functional eyesight, and my marriage to Meredith ended. It was a brutally awful time. With the help of family and friends, I got through it. On January 30th, 1993, my dad died suddenly of a massive heart attack. The telephone call came at 8:30 a.m. on a bright, crisp winter morning. I was alone at home because my wife and children had left to run errands. I had just finished breakfast when the telephone rang. It was my law partner, Larry Rocamora. "Craig, your mother just called and told me that your father suffered a major heart attack." "Is he okay?" I asked him. "I don't know," Larry responded. "He's en route to County Hospital." My hand shook as I put down the receiver. I immediately called my in-laws to obtain a ride to the hospital. My heart began to race. Panic began to set in. As I walked from the family room to the dining room, I felt sunlight pouring through the cathedral windows. I had seen my dad through this window several months before as he mowed my front yard. He was dressed in dark pants and a dark pullover shirt. With his back turned to me as he was mowing the yard, I noticed his white hair and the bald spot at the back of his head. I remember thinking that my dad had grown old. I saw my dad again that morning as I looked out of the window. He was dressed the same way, but there was no lawnmower this time. Instead, he simply turned to me in the window and waved goodbye. I stood stunned in that window for a long time. As I turned from the window, my mind filled with pictures and visions of him and recollections of the past. I was overwhelmed. To her credit, my mother-in-law, Elizabeth, raced from her house to mine and undoubtedly broke many traffic laws in between. We raced from my house to Durham County General Hospital, and when we arrived, no members of my family were there. I knew what that meant, but I quietly walked to the emergency room where my dad had been taken. When I entered the room, I saw his body on the steel bed frame of the emergency room bed. His eyes were open, but his body was motionless. His shirt was torn open where the defibrillator pads had sought to revive him, but to no avail. The remnants of a breathing tube were in his mouth, and remnants of IV tubes were stuck in his right arm. I approached his body, and I touched it, and it was cold, and I knew he was gone. My eyes welled with tears, and my heart jumped in great despair. Elizabeth met me at the doorway, and she took my arm tenderly as I began to cry. She led me back to her car and put me in the seat, and as we left together, I let out a shrill death cry, the likes of which I have never heard before or since. Had I really seen my dad that morning? Did he really appear before me and wave goodbye? To this day, I do not know the answer to those questions. All I know is that at that moment, I sensed that my dad was dead. I will always miss him. However, as he always said, I just kept on moving. Work, family, two kids. There was always a hole after he died, though, and my situation got worse. My eyesight was continuing to diminish, both in terms of visual acuity and contrast. I began to focus on remembering what I could see. In the summer of 1994, I flew to visit two old college friends in Denver, Colorado. As the plane banked and we circled to land at the Denver airport, I saw the jagged features of Pike's Peak jutting abruptly from the surrounding landscape into the sky. I still had some eyesight left. My old college roommate, Trey, met me at the airport. As I deployed my folding cane after walking out of the jetway, he looked puzzled, even stunned. He had heard the news about my fight with blindness for many years, but the full realization shook him. He told me later that he and Kathy had cried that night. The difference between my brave rhetoric and my sad reality had become telling, especially amongst my friends who had not seen me for a while. On the third day of my trip, we drove to the Rocky Mountain National Park above Denver. Their cars zigzagged up the mountains, and I noted every mountain pass, every mountain valley. The rugged, rocky, tree-lined landscape was spectacular, and I took in every bit of it. Finally, about 45 minutes later, we reached the crest of the mountain pass and stopped at an overlook. My tennis shoes crunched on a thin layer of snow as I walked slowly to the edge of the rock-lined overlook. It was strange to have snow on the ground in June, but we were at 14,000 feet. I laughed. The lightning that afternoon was perfect. The contrast was crisp, and I felt that I could see forever. I stared silently in awe at the Continental Divide. I had not seen it before, and I knew that I would never see it again. A series of fur-lined mountain peaks cascaded sharply into the Green River Valley below as far as the eye could see. I will never forget the awesome beauty of that moment. That fall, my wife and I paid a visit to the Lighthouse for the Blind in New York City. The trip was disappointing, if not depressing. The results showed that the visual field in my right eye was becoming smaller and my ability to see contrast was diminishing. Moreover, there was no new medical technology that could assist my faltering eyesight. Like any good tourists, Meredith and I went by ferry to see Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty. By that point, I could see nothing in bright sunlight other than glare. My eyesight in darkened rooms was even worse. As we returned from Ellis Island, the lightning again was perfect. To my left and behind me, I could clearly see the gleaming golden statue of Liberty's skirt, the lines of her face and shoulders, the arch of her right hand as it raised the torch of Liberty to the sky. Turning right, I saw the beautiful skyline of Manhattan dancing in the warm autumn sunlight. I will forever relish the sight of the deep blue hue of the Pan American Building, the soft green of the Chrysler Building, and the rose twin towers of the World Trade Center. I took it all in, and I will remember. Shortly after my second capital case, I could no longer read under any lighting conditions. After almost 20 years of battling my illness, the sand in the hourglass had run out, and I was blind. I was devastated. I had denied my impending blindness for many years. Denial is a wonderful defense mechanism, but reality is stronger. I had many years to prepare for my blindness, but I stubbornly clung to the notion that I would always see something. When blindness finally came, it was a crushing blow, and I was unprepared. The blackness of depression rolled in again. Like many depressed people, I continued to function at work, but my heart was not in it. Outwardly, I was maintaining the faith, but inside, I was panicking. I was sullen and detached, and for a moment, I did not know what to do. In mid-October 1995, Meredith and I flew to Baltimore for an appointment at the Johns Hopkins Eye Center. An eye specialist in Durham had recommended because it is considered the preeminent eye center in the United States. We went there to look at the latest in vision enhancement equipment for people like me with impairments. On our way from the hotel to the medical center, I gazed through my visual fog out the taxi window at the fall foliage. I knew my eyesight had begun its final fade, and I was hopeful, ever hopeful, that we could find a magic solution. The technician adjusted the computerized visual enhancement device that resembled something out of a Star Wars film. As I positioned my eyes next to the device, I thought that I was going to see clearly for the first time in more than a month. I waited. Nothing. The technician adjusted my headset again. Again. Nothing. We moved to an adjacent room. Speaking softly, the technician said, "Mr. Brown, there is nothing we can do. Your visual field is too small for the new equipment to assist you." I sat there, trying to comprehend exactly what he was telling me. "But what about artificial eyes or an eye transplant?" I pleaded. The technician pondered my question briefly, then quietly sighed. At that moment, I knew what was coming, but I did not want to hear his response. "Your optic nerves are too damaged to permit the connection of either of these devices when they become available," he told me. "Mr. Brown, there is no hope." Well, I thought, at least he was honest about it. As if someone threw a heavy wet blanket over my shoulders, I was consumed with despair. After a 20-year battle against blindness, the battle was over. I was blind. After steroid therapy, chemotherapy, 2 artificial lens implants, 6 laser surgeries, hope, prayer, and the kitchen sink, the battle was over, and I had lost. The realization rattled me. How could I lose after having done so much? No one spoke, not me, not Meredith, not the technician. I broke the silence, which lasted for what seemed to me to be an eternity. "What can I do?" I asked them. "You have to go into intensive rehabilitation and retraining. You've avoided it for much too long." "But where do I go?" His reply was instantaneous and unwavering. "Lions World, Services for the Blind in Little Rock, Arkansas. It's the best program in the country." Predictably, my first marriage failed too. A week after our trip to Johns Hopkins, Meredith left me for the first time. "Craig, I am leaving you unless you get some help," she told me. I knew that she was right. I set up my retraining at Lions World in Little Rock, Arkansas. Meredith and the children returned. I was halfway across the country, and the distance between Meredith and me seemed to grow even greater. I called every night and spoke to my 3 and 6-year-old daughters, but Meredith was increasingly distant and noncommittal. "We'll have to see where things stand when you get back," she told me. When I got off the plane coming back from Lions World in late November, Meredith waited for me at the gate. We hugged. I was happy to see her. I told her about all the things that I'd learned at Lions World over the past month. Then, walking down the corridor, I missed a turn. Meredith cleared her throat, and, at that moment, I knew our marriage was over. Despite my retraining efforts, I was still blind with all the baggage that comes with it. 3 months later, she would leave for good. I do not remember much about the next several months. In a way, the days all blurred into darkness. I needed help, and for the first time, I sought the help of a psychologist. Therapy is not for the faint-hearted. At best, it is a brutal and difficult process. I had piled up years of denial, guilt, and shame about my blindness, among many other things. It would take the better share of 3 years to get me back on track, and I am still working on it. My marriage was over. For the first time in 10 years, I was alone and I was blind. We agreed to tell the children the following week, but my oldest daughter, Laura, figured it out beforehand. The next morning, Meredith called to tell me that the children knew that we had separated. My devastated 6-year-old daughter came to the phone. "Daddy," her voice cracked, "will I ever see you again?" Her words stuck in my throat. Driving a railroad tie through my heart would have been easier. "Of course, Laura," I reassured her. She dropped the phone and ran away crying. Apparently, one of her school friends had just been through a divorce. Afterwards, she never saw her father very much, and Laura thought that it would be the same with me. She was very mistaken, but she did not know that then. To her credit, Meredith never denied me my children. With the exception of a few business trips, I never missed visitation. When the children came over to spend the night later that week, Susanna, Laura, and I lay down in the master bed to sleep. I began to cry, softly at first, then more loudly. Laura sat up and patted my head. "It'll be okay, Daddy," she told me. "You were just blind, Daddy. You will always be our daddy." Out of the mouths of my babes, the truth came. I am sure that they did not fully realize what they were saying to me that night, but I will always remember. In the broadest context, the lesson of this chapter is that life never turns out the way you planned it. I did not expect my dad to die so young. I did not expect to lose my eyesight entirely. And I did not expect that my first marriage would end in a divorce. I am certain that my blindness was as difficult for her as it was for me. Sometimes, just like my mom always said, it is what it is. You make the best decision possible, and you live with the consequences. My friend, Marty Horn, began dropping by almost every day. He did not have to do that, but he chose to, and I appreciated it. My closer friends began stopping by and calling on a regular basis, too. Years later, I am very grateful for their help and intervention during this difficult time. Like the song says, that's what friends are for. The adversity made me stronger, and sometimes I feel like the Man of Steel. But I am not. There was more yet to come. Chapter 11. I Am a Bat. The Road to Independence. Even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. Psalm 139:12. If the Lord delights in a man's way, he makes his step firm. Though he stumble, he will not fall, for the Lord upholds him with his hand. Psalm 37:23-24. I knew the time had finally come to confront the darkness. It was a cool, sunny afternoon when I flew into Little Rock. A Lion World staff member met me at the gate. "My name is Grace," she told me. "Welcome to Lion's World." As I used my cane to make my way down the baggage claim area, she criticized my technique. "Sloppy," she said. When we got into the van and headed to downtown Little Rock, she further told me that I had a lot to learn, one thing being that I needed to learn how to live as a blind person, not as a sighted person who just happened to be blind. "This is going to be a little more difficult than I thought," I responded. "You'll be fine," Grace assured me. With that, we drove the remainder of the way in silence. The Lion's World facility encompasses an entire city block in downtown Little Rock. It is comprised of 3 3-story adjoining buildings and a separate administration building with a large courtyard in the center. We got to the check-in counter where I received a room key. Grace was kind enough to show me to my room. As I opened the door, I felt like I was going back to college. Even though I could not see it clearly, I examined my room by walking the perimeter and feeling the size and location of furniture. Deja vu, my freshman dorm year. I was staying in a moderately sized dormitory-style room with an adjacent bathroom. I exchanged greetings with my new roommate, Fred, who was from Rhode Island. "Are you blind?" I nervously asked him, as if sighted people came to Lion's world. "I have retinal pigmentosa," he responded. "I haven't lost all my eyesight yet, but I soon will." Fred explained his family history to me and how he and one of his siblings had retinal pigmentosa and that their two other siblings did not. He still had some of his eyesight, but was not able to drive a car and was not using a cane. He was single, 30 years old, and his sight problems were starting to affect his personal life. Even though he had been to college, he knew he needed more training to hang on to a career as an accountant. On my first day to class, I got around quite nicely because there was a guide to show me where to go. On the second day, no one was there. It was now up to me. Somehow, I got to all of my seven classes, although I was usually late. That night, I decided I had better get busy figuring out how to get around the Lion's World facility. I was practicing the turns and steps from class to class. I started to realize how incredibly daunting a task it can be to get around when you are blind. I was realizing that Grace was right. I had a lot to learn. As I caned my way down the first floor of my building, I literally ran into a man who would become my best friend at Lion's World. "What are you doing?" the male voice asked. "I'm trying to figure out how to get around this place," I said. I heard a laugh. "You must be newly blind." "Yes, I am. My name is Craig Brown, and I'm from North Carolina." "I'm Rick from Illinois," he responded. "I got here this morning." "So, would you mind telling me how you can get around so well?" I asked. "I'm a bat," Rick responded, laughing again. That was not the answer that I expected. "What do you mean?" "You've got to learn to listen well. Here, let me show you." Rick led me, cane in hand, to the courtyard area outside. "What do you hear now?" he asked. I stood still for a moment, carefully listening. I hear faint automobile traffic and a heating unit above me. "Good! What does that tell you?" "There's a street nearby, and there's an outside heating unit on one of the buildings here." "That's right." "You've got to learn to use sound as a beacon to where you need to go," Rick told me. I realized he had a lot of information to share, and I wanted to know more. "What do you mean?" "Let's walk around for a minute, and I'll tell you." Side by side, we began to stroll through the facility. "Learn to grid everything in your mind," Rick began. "After you've constructed your metal grid, you use the wind, sun, and sound to locate yourself on the grid. After all, you can hear buildings." Then I laughed. I thought he was nuts. Whoever heard of buildings that you could hear? Rick was silent. "Remember, Craig, you're blind. You're a bat." We continued to cane down the sidewalk, then turned to our left. "What do you hear now?" "The traffic noise is closer," I replied. "The heating unit has moved farther to our left." "The increasing traffic noise means we're getting closer to the street. You should always use the sound of that heating unit to locate where you are in the courtyard," he instructed me. I still thought he was a bit nuts, but the more he talked, the more I listened. I asked him, "What do you mean by hearing buildings?" Instead of answering directly, Rick laughed again. "Let's find out." We approached our first building. "What did you notice as we approached the building?" he asked. "I don't know," I told him. "You really are a newly blind," he said with a chuckle. "As you approach a building, you should notice that the air currents change." Well, in my life, I had never paid attention to a nuance like that. "Try it and see," Rick told me. I did, and I must say he was right. As I got closer to the building, the air currents did change and died down considerably. "What else changes as you get closer to a building?" Rick asked me. Still feeling clueless, I said, I have no idea. air pressure, he said. As you get really close to a building, the air pressure will drop and the air current will become completely still. Blindness is a brave new world, I thought. We turned around. What do you hear now? Rick asked. I hear the heating unit again, and I hear a door opening and closing, I said. Good. You're learning. What does that tell you? The heating unit is probably on the roof of the building we came out of. The door sounds are probably from the door we came out of when we entered the courtyard. Rick laughed again. There is hope for you, Craig. In fact, the noise of the door was indeed the same door we used. The heating unit was, in fact, on the roof of that building. This brave new world was beginning to make more sense. I was feeling relieved and convinced that Rick was not crazy, but instead, a genius. Over the next month, Rick taught me everything he knew about gridding, both inside and out. My cane instructor, Lisa, helped with a number of new cane techniques. I learned to tell time by the height of the sun on my face and to tell direction by the sun as well. I learned to judge distance by sound. I learned how to memorize the layout of any particular building or any particular room. By the end of the second week, I could even get around the maze that Lion's World made you go through to get from place to place. During that time, I learned more about Rick, who became a close friend during our time at Lion's World. He was a Native American in his early 40s, who had lost his eyesight because of a blasting cap accident when he was a six-year-old. He was attending a training course to qualify for work at the Marriott Hotel chain. Before I went to Lion's World, I had met very few blind people. I had purposely avoided them, as if meeting them would mean that I would become one of them. I remember how I would avert my eyes when I saw someone in a wheelchair or with a cane. In some ways, blindness is the best of disabilities. You do not have to worry about people looking at you because you cannot see them. Before I became disabled, I never realized that disabled people are ordinary people with disabilities. We have dreams and hopes like anyone. We laugh and cry. However, unlike those without a disability, we must learn to live and deal with the limitations of our particular disability. We ask only that you treat us with respect that is due to any human being. On my third day at Lion's World, I met John, a former steelworker from New Orleans who was in his early 30s. Over a period of 2 months, he had completely lost his eyesight as well as his construction career. Simultaneously, his first marriage ended when he attempted suicide. After hearing his life story, I was reminded again that blindness is a terrible thing. After overcoming blindness, divorce, and a failed suicide attempt, John had completely turned around. Since those dark times, he had engaged in intensive retraining, especially with computers. While there are many basic skills that our schools for the blind need to provide to the visually impaired, computers offer a way out for some of the blind and disabled. John was a quiet but intense person who spoke bluntly from experience. Rick and I met John for coffee one evening in the lounge area at Lion's World. We introduced ourselves and gave a brief version of our life histories. I was amazed at how similar all of them were. After I finished my story, John told me four sentences that I will always remember. Life sucks, Craig. Get over it. Move on. Make something of it. Stunned by the audacity of anyone trying to sum up my life in just four sentences, I challenged him to explain himself. Well, he responded, look at the people who are here. You can break them down into three categories, the independents, the lifers, and the lost. The independents are those people who will come here, learn the necessary skills, go back home, get a job, and apply them. They will never rely substantially on Social Security, and they will do the best they can. The lifers rely on Social Security all the time, but go through a program like this one as often as they can, without focus or result. The lost don't have a clue. I thought about his remarks. While I cannot agree about the definitiveness of his categories, John had a point. Our conversation turned to relationships, and John had more bad news. After hearing of my marital difficulties, John was blunt and to the point. "Craig, your marriage is probably over," John told me. "Well, how can you say that?" I asked him. "You've only known me for about half an hour, and you've never met my wife." 90% of all marriages fail when one partner becomes disabled, John explained. Total disability completely changes the dependence and the dynamics of any relationship. Then there was Eddie, who was a Cherokee Indian from North Carolina in his mid-20s. He had lost his eyes as a child and had two artificial ones. One of his favorite things to do in front of a sighted audience was to pull one of them out. There is nothing like grossing out the sighted folks. Eddie was attending the horticultural program at Lions World, and we became friends. Eddie had one uncanny ability, even though he was blind. He could walk around without a cane. "All you have to do is listen, Craig," he told me, reiterating what Rick had taught me earlier. Sometime in mid-November, I went with Eddie and several other residents to a local drinking establishment near Lions World. You can imagine the scene. Five blind guys walking down the street to a bar. The term, blind drunk, took on a new meaning. Lions World residents had been going to this bar for many years. Light conversation followed. Several of the group got up and went to play football. Eddie and I were alone at the table. We struck up a conversation. "Eddie, how do you do it? You're so cheerful all the time. How do you avoid the depression of blindness?" Eddie sipped on his beer, then thoughtfully responded. "You turn around and you face the darkness. You let depression envelop you. Know that you will come out on the other side." When I look back at those words now, I realized how insightful and true they were. 2 months later, I was talking with my therapist, Robert Laws. It was my first visit, and I was telling him my life story. After listening to me for about 15 minutes, he said, "Craig, you're not very good at being blind. Your blindness simply is, and you need to deal with it. By dealing with it, by confronting it, you can move on with your life. You can't go beyond the blindness." It was at that moment that everything I had learned at Lions World became clear. I am blind. I do not like it, and I never will. But I have a future. At that moment, I decided that to live my life, I needed to accept what was and live. Live with the blindness, and not let being blind stand in my way of living. Whatever the nature of your disability, you need to confront it. If you have difficulty confronting the reality of your situation, get help. There are many psychologists who can help you through the 5 stages of dealing with your tragedy. Recruit your family and your friends to help you. You will best move on if you face your own difficulties, break through the darkness, and accept the reality of your new life. Chapter 12, The Call to Public Service. When life kicks you, let it kick forward. Kay Yao, North Carolina State women's basketball coach. From my excellent blind retraining at Lions World, I realized that it would be extremely difficult to maintain my private litigation practice as a blind man. I had to shift my occupation to fit my blindness. A practicing courtroom attorney needed to keep his eyes on the jury, the witness, the judge, and the opposing counsel to watch for sudden changes in their body language during the course of the testimony and trial. A judge, on the other hand, hears arguments from all sides before he renders a decision. I first began thinking about running for Durham County District Court judge in early 1996. I knew then that William Y. Manson, currently a serving judge, intended to retire at the end of his term in December 1998. One has to prepare well in advance to run for a judicial post. That same month, I met with several prominent attorneys whom I had known since I began practicing in 1983. Travis Porter was a powerful attorney in Durham County, having built the largest local law firm in the city. In his spare time, he served as chairman of the UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees, as well as chairman of the UNC Board of Governors. He was an extremely powerful ally of Governor Jim Hunt. He had been active in Durham politics since the mid-1960s. He was an excellent bridge to the black community, one of the few white businessmen in Durham who had accomplished that feat. I had known Travis Porter since college, where his son Greg was one of my best friends at Carolina. The Porter family took this out-of-state student from Iowa under their wing. We would go over to the Porter house in Durham on some weekends during the school year to eat or watch basketball and football games. I got to know the whole Porter family as well, his mother, Jane, and his two brothers, Daryl and Chris. Travis Porter was simply larger than life. He had a booming voice, and like me, he liked to talk about his experiences, his life, and the people he came into contact with, good or bad. Ex-Marines are like that. His favorite quote was, "Another day, another chance to excel." I also like that. His experience, expertise, and friendship were all key to him serving as an initial advisor for my election effort. As the spring progressed, I began trying to attract other lawyers to support my future candidacy. To complete the campaign committee chairman, I sought the support of Brian Ouse, another Durham lawyer. Brian and I had worked on a capital case together. That was the State versus Nelms. Later, we had served as co-counsel on death row case in North Carolina, State versus Timothy Keel. It was a tremendous joy to work with him, and he was well-respected within the Durham bar. At that point, I had both a former prosecutor and a present defense counsel on board. The ticket, however, needed to be complemented by a substantial civil practice. To that end, I sought the assistance of Jimmy Sharp, a well-respected domestic attorney in Durham. He would provide a link to the civil bar, which is the largest element of the bar in Durham County when it comes to district court. Then suddenly, rumors began surfacing about Manson's early retirement. I first heard of those rumors in late spring of 1996, and they persisted. On June 15th of 1996, Judge Manson announced his retirement in the Durham Herald, and the campaign was on. During the months of June and July, I called every single attorney in Durham County. Seriously, I did. All 800 of them. By the time I was finished, I had my 3-minute voicemail down pat. The Durham County Bar Association voted for its top 3 choices for the vacant district court judgeship in Durham County. Ann McGovern got 242 votes. I received 152. And Marcia Morey received 136 votes. Little do we know that all of us would become district court judges in our own right within the next 3 years, and we each served ably thereafter. The next morning, former Durham City Mayor and then State Senator Whip Gully approached Hunt's legislative counsel Jim Phillips and State Senate Majority Leader Roy Cooper on the Senate floor. Gully advised them of the Durham County bar vote and asked for support of his candidate. Phillips and Cooper looked at each other, then at Gully. Almost in unison, they told Gully, "We're for Brown." From that point forward, Gully knew that his candidate was in trouble. It turned out that many of my Carolina classmates had become state leaders. I did not know in 1979, for example, that my college friend Jim Phillips would rise to become legislative counsel for North Carolina Governor James B. Hunt, Jr. I also did not know then that my Carolina classmate, Roy Cooper, would become State Senate Majority Leader, or that David Price, who was a professor of mine teaching political ethics at Duke University in 1981, would become a U.S. Congressman from the 4th District, which includes Durham County. Sometimes strong friendships from the past catapult you into your future yet to be. Like anyone seeking a political appointment, I sought to touch all my bases and talk to all of my potential supporters. I figured that none of the remaining candidates had the support of Terry Sanford, and as a graduate of Duke's Public Policy School, which was now named after him, I called him for an appointment. "Hello?" a gruff voice answered the phone. I was surprised. There are not many former U.S. state senators who answer their own business calls. "Senator Sanford?" I asked him. "Yes," the gruff voice responded. I explained to him who I was and why I needed to see him. Surprisingly, he told me to meet him at his office at 10 a.m. the next day. Terry Sanford was and is a legend in North Carolina Democratic politics. Elected governor of North Carolina in 1960, he thereafter spent 15 years as president of Duke University and then was elected to the United States Senate in 1986. Now, nearly 80 years of age, he was revered and loved throughout the state, and most especially in his hometown of Durham. The following day, I arrived at my scheduled appointment promptly. His secretary announced my presence, and I was led to his office. I walked in the door nervously. "Come on in," Senator Sanford said as he spotted me in the doorway. I took a couple of steps forward, and I handed him my letter of introduction and my resume. Sanford was an imposing man, more than 6 foot tall, with distinct features, broad shoulders, white hair, and an astute mind. Sanford glanced at my resume and then looked up a little quizzically. I was not ready for his opening question. "So, what's it like to be blind?" he asked intently. His question did not surprise me. I fully expected that he would ask it, but I certainly didn't expect it as the first question, and I reeled. Most people are curious about blindness, but very few actually ask about it. I rocked back and forth on my feet. Thoughts ran through my head as I considered his question. Should I be intellectual? No, that would take too long and be entirely confusing. Should I be stoic? No, that denies reality. So I was honest, and it was the easiest thing. "Well," I told him, "it sucks." I still cannot believe that I answered his first question that way, but at least he knew that he had a live one here. Senator Sanford chuckled and briefly roared. "Sit down and let's talk some," he told me. I took a seat, and for the next hour we had a far-reaching discussion on my background in education, my experience, the state of racial justice in North Carolina, and the impact of poverty on it. I was fascinated. I am told that I had his support when he spoke to Governor Hunt about my appointment to the bench. I've never confirmed that fact, but judging from our conversation, I believe it to be true. Hunt and Sanford apparently talked almost every day. My mom, Shirley, never fully recovered from my dad's death in 1993. They were married for so long and had such a keen partnership that she was lost without him. In the weeks and months that followed my dad's death, she fell into depression and lost a considerable amount of weight. Since Mom was never a heavy woman, weight loss was a serious problem. Without my dad, she was incredibly lonely. Whatever her medical cause of death to this day, I believe that she died of a broken heart. In August of 1996, Mom fell while she was working in the yard, injuring her right leg. At the age of 69, her skin had become like parchment, and the resulting tear never healed properly. Mom spent several weeks at Durham Regional Hospital recovering, and my brother Chris did yeoman's work in finding a rehabilitation center for her to go to for the following recovery. She was transferred there on September the 5th. That night, Hurricane Fran struck with a vengeance in North Carolina, causing over $2 billion in property and other damages. I have never seen Durham so torn up. Trees were down everywhere. Power was out over most of Durham for over a week. Everything stopped. I saw her last on the early afternoon of Sunday, September 8th. My brother Chris was kind enough to give me a ride over to the rehabilitation center north of Durham. We walked quietly to her room, and Chris left so Mom and I could talk. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw sunlight shimmering through the yellow curtains behind her. I was struck, even stunned, by her appearance. Her complexion was a pasty white. The hair had turned completely white as well. I gulped. "It will not be long," I thought to myself. Mom had not always been lucid in the past month. Our initial conversation rambled from topic to topic. She became increasingly impatient with me. Suddenly, she became entirely lucid and pointed in remarks. "Craig, I am very proud of you for all you have accomplished in your life. You will accomplish much more, but I always remember what your father said," she recited. I knew quite well what she was referring to. Tears welled up in my eyes and my throat grew husky. I knew the words well and I repeated them to her, my voice breaking. Always remember, whatever you accomplish in life, that you will put your pants on the same way just like everyone else. She smiled again. Come, give your mother a kiss, she told me. I reached over to her face and kissed her lightly on the lips. I love you, Craig. Go for it. Those last seven words that my mom spoke to me are burned in my memory. I will remember them always. As a result of the hurricane, Chris and I were both staying at Mom's house, which was the only one with power. We were watching Monday Night Football, which was the game between the Philadelphia Eagles and the Green Bay Packers. The fog was so thick that night that we could barely see the game. About 10:30 p.m., the Brown family Bible mysteriously fell from the top shelf of the bookcase onto the floor. This was quite a surprise, since the Bible weighed about 6 pounds and was 8 inches by 12 inches in size. I did not give any special significance to this fact until later. We looked at the Bible, which was made sometime in the early 1900s. The Bible also included a genealogy of the Brown family, as well as pictures of Dad as an infant and others of him as a football player on the Fayette High School Iowa football team. It was quite a trip back. We then went to bed. About 1:30 a.m. on September 10th, there was a pounding on the front door of Mom's residence. Chris's family and I were staying there. My estranged wife and children were safe in the mountains of North Carolina, which received little impact of the storm. But I knew what had happened. Police did not come seeking you out unless something terrible had occurred. I pretended not to hear the noise of the front door, even though my bedroom was directly next to it. Somehow, I hoped that the noise would go away and that the message that I feared would be forthcoming would not come. But my brother again, bless his heart, answered the door. The police officers directed him to contact Trayburn Rehabilitation Center. He did so and learned that Mom was dead. The death certificate said that she had died of heart failure at about 10:30 the night before, the same time that the Bible had fallen. I am certain of one thing, that she and Dad are together in heaven, having a good time. After several hours of intermixed crying and talking, we tried to go back to sleep. I did not sleep. I showed up at the office the next morning heartbroken. At approximately 10 a.m. that morning, I contacted Governor Jim Hunt's office. I was scheduled for an interview with the governor regarding my judicial appointment later that day. I requested a postponement in light of my mom's death the night before. I spoke to a lady by the name of Judy Harp. She said that she would call me back. Approximately 1.5 hour later, Mrs. Harp called me to tell me that the interview would go forward. I then contacted my therapist to get his advice regarding how I should get through this interview. Brian House drove me to Raleigh. He did not mention my mom during the trip, nor did I. I can still remember the swish of the windshield wipers as we drove through the pouring rain to Raleigh. Somehow it was calming. Arriving early, we waited patiently under one of the parking decks for the rain to slow down before we walked the 2 blocks to the state capitol. Finally, with 30 minutes to spare, the rain began to subside, and we began our journey. There were still trees down in the state capitol grounds from Hurricane Fran. As we arrived, the governor's office in the state capitol was abuzz with disaster details. North Carolina was in the process of cleaning up from the worst storm it had ever received. We were told that we were early, but that events were ahead of schedule and to have a seat. We would learn later what had transpired.
This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is prepared in cooperation with the North Carolina Institute on Blindness. We will be back next week with a continuation of A Fork in the Road by Craig Brown.